sacred, if conducted, recognizing the sanctity of the other involved, whether a person or a foodstuff or an object that you use. Of all the loving acts that two human beings are capable of, the simple act of holding hands can often become the most intimate. Why is this so? Basically, because the nature of the hands and feet is such, the energy system finds expression in these two parts of the body in a very singular way. Two palms coming together have far more intimacy than the contact between any other parts of the body. You can try this with yourself. You don't even need a partner. When you put your hands together, the two energy dimensions within you, right, left, masculine, feminine, solar, lunar, yin, yang, Shiva, Shakti, are linked in a certain way, and you begin to experience a sense of unity within yourself. This is the logic of the traditional Indian Namaskar. It is a means of harmonizing the system. So the simplest way to experience a state of union is to try this simple Namaskar Yoga. Put your hands together. Pay loving attention to any object you use or consume or any form of life that you encounter. When you bring this sense of awareness into every simple act, your experience of life will never be the same again. There is even a possibility that if you put your hands together, you could unite the world. Hormonal hijack. I was once asked, isn't it strange that people are more obsessed with sex than any other physical urge? Nothing strange about it. It is just the hormonal hijack we talked about earlier. In any case, sex is not the most powerful urge. Hunger is. Most of the time, thinking about sex is just compulsive behavior. When you were a child, it did not matter what reproductive organ someone had. The moment hormones started playing with you, you could not think of the world beyond that. You will see that after a certain age, when the play of hormones subsides, once again it will not matter. You will look back and not believe you were the one obsessing about it. There is nothing wrong with the body. It is just limited. Nothing wrong with being limited either. If you go by the way of the body, some pleasure may come to you. It is not a crime to want to be limited, but you will live a life unfulfilled. Let us say tomorrow, I grant you a boon and all the women or men in the world are lusting after you. You will find that you are still not satisfied. A little bit of pleasure and pain will happen, but you will only live within the sphere of the body. The body knows only survival and procreation. It is walking straight to the grave every moment, nowhere else. Your body is just a loan from this planet. What you call death is just Mother Earth reclaiming the loan that she offered to you. All life on the planet is just a recycle of the Earth. You may think right now you are going to your office, home, or football match, but as far as your body is concerned, it is going, moment by moment, straight toward the grave. Right now, you may have forgotten, but slowly as time passes, it will become more apparent that this is the nature of the body. If all that you have known is body, anyway you are going to lose it, anxiety and fear will be your constant companions. People are even beginning to think that fear is a natural part of their existence. No. Fear is a result of incompleteness of your existence. If you have not explored life in its magnitude and multidimensionality, but have limited yourself to the physical body, fear is a natural consequence. Ever heard of George Best? He was one of the greatest footballers of his time in England. He was determined to make the most of his life in the way he knew best. Media described him as having every popular film star and fashion model on his arm at some time or the other. But by the time he reached the age of 35, he was a broken, miserable, frustrated man. By the age of 59, he was dead. Death is not the issue, but the way you live is the issue. George Best supposedly had it all, but he lived a terrible life. This is because the way of the physical is circumscribed. The body has only so much of a role to play in your life. If you try to stretch it to all of your life, you will suffer because you are trying to create a falsehood. Life has a million ingenious ways to bend you, break you, knead you, and grind you. Nothing wrong with your hormones, but once you live a compulsive life, you are living a life of a slave. Everything may be going on fine with your life, your business, family, relationships, but slowly, as different kinds of compulsions take over, you grow more and more miserable. There is something within you that is unwilling to be a slave. For many, the pursuit of wealth and physical well-being drives them to increasingly desperate actions. If you look under the veneer of civilization, you will uncover the most abominable forms of abuse. We are not even sparing our own children. These are the consequences of not attending to all the dimensions of the human being and limiting ourselves to the narrow realm of the physical. Today, in attempting to fetishize the body, people are creating untold suffering. You cannot think of a better arrangement materially in terms of health care, insurance, cars. You have more comforts and conveniences than any previous generation, but people are suffering immensely. In affluent societies, almost every fifth person is on some kind of medication just to maintain mental balance. When you have to take a tablet every day to remain sane, this is not joyfulness. You are on the verge of breaking down because you have made a small aspect of your life the whole of your life. Mortality and profundity. Only when you recognize your mortal nature do you want to know what more there is to life. It is then that spiritual process opens up. Once it happened, two men over 80 years of age met. One recognized the other and said, "Did you fight in World War II?" The other man said, "Yes." The first asked him where and in which battalion. The other man told him. The first exclaimed, "Oh my God, don't you recognize me? We were in the same foxhole." Oh, they hit it off. They talked and talked. All that they had actually seen was about 40 minutes of intense combat situation. But they talked about every bullet that went by, zing, zing, just missing them by inches. They spoke for over 4 hours about those 40 minutes. When they had exhausted everything that they could say about that time, one asked the other, "What have you been doing since the war?" "Oh, for the past 60 years, I've just been a salesman." Those 40 minutes had come to define their lives because their mortality was dangling in front of them at every moment. In battle, they had forged a bond that was profound. Beyond that, this man's life could be summed up in a single sentence. He was just a salesman. You discover an indescribable profundity within yourself when you realize your mortal nature. If you have not realized your eternal nature, you must at least realize your mortal nature. Death is not the end of life. Death is simply the end of the body. If you have lived with a very deep identification with the physical, the more you will struggle with death, because death marks the end of the body. Only when you confront your mortality, the potential but inevitable termination of your physical form, does the longing to go beyond become genuine. mind, miracle or mess. Once it happened, a man wished to acquire supernatural powers. He went from one guru to another, desperately in search of instruction. He eventually found his way to a remote hermitage in the Himalayan wilderness. The guru of the ashram divined the purpose of his quest and tried to dissuade him. "What will you do with these powers? So what if you learn to walk upon water? After 3 days, a boat will be better. Don't waste your life on these irrelevant pursuits. Let me teach you meditation instead." The master made many attempts to dissuade him, but the man was adamant. The guru finally said, "Well, if you're determined, take a dip in the river tomorrow morning at 4 o'clock and come to me. I will initiate you into the secrets of the supernatural." The man was excited. He took a pre-dawn dip in a freezing Himalayan river, turned half blue, and came and sat expectantly before the master. The guru said, "See, this is very simple. I have a secret mantra. If you utter it 3 times over, for the next 40 days, all the supernatural powers will be yours." He then revealed the mantra, "Asatoma Sadgamaya. From ignorance, lead me to truth." The guru said, "You have to repeat this sacred mantra 3 times a day for the next 40 days, and the entire realm of the supernatural will be yours. But when uttering the mantra, just don't think of monkeys." The man was incredulous at the simplicity of the practice. "Is that all?" he asked joyfully. "May I leave now?" The guru said, "By all means, please go and return in 40 days. The man left in a state of great excitement. "The fool of a guru revealed all his secrets to me without even charging a fee. And he is telling me not to think of monkeys. Why would I think of monkeys? Ridiculous." He came down the mountainside and reached the banks of River Ganga. He took a dip in the holy river, sat down to begin his practice. But no sooner he uttered the word Asatoma and monkeys. Each time a monkey popped into his head, he took another dip in the river. He attempted the mantra in various yogic postures, but each time he uttered the very first syllable, monkeys would appear. In 1 week of intense practice, there was no need for a mantra anymore. It was a universe full of monkeys, a simian nightmare. Harassed by these countless monkeys, unable to do a thing, the man went all the way back to the guru and said, "I don't want your damn supernatural powers. Relieve me of these monkeys first. If you tell yourself you don't want to think of a certain thought, that is precisely the first thing your mind will produce. That is the nature of the mind." In recent times, much scientific research has been conducted on the activity of the brain. If you look at the way neurons fire in the brain, there is a tremendous cohesiveness in this activity. It is this cohesiveness that translates into efficient functioning of the body. 1 billion sophisticated activities are being performed in your body right now because of the highly coordinated and complex dance of neurons. But the mind in most people's experience has unfortunately become a circus. A circus is actually a very coordinated activity deliberately made to look like a mess. Even the clown in the circus is a gymnast. He may play the buffoon, but he is hugely talented and skillful in what he is doing. The metaphor of the clown sums up the experience of most people when it comes to their mental activity. How did the mind, that amazing gymnast, become a clown? How did it turn from a source of magic to such a mess? Why has this miraculous instrument become such a misery manufacturing machine? As noted earlier, every human being is essentially seeking pleasantness within and without. When it comes to the outside, there are a million ingredients, and nobody has complete mastery over them. When it comes to the inner situation, however, there is only one ingredient, you. You can be the sole architect and creator of your inner life, but you don't know how. That is the rub. If you were in charge, for sure, you would not manufacture misery for yourself. A fundamental freedom you have is to think whatever you want. What then stops you from thinking pleasant thoughts? The problem is just this. The fact that your mind is not taking instructions from you. Imagine a Paleolithic caveman punching a computer keyboard. What's going to come up on the screen will look like a series of obscenities. The system of yoga is a technology to create a distinction between you and your mind. There is a space between you and what you have gathered in terms of body and mind. Becoming conscious of this space is your first and only step to freedom. It is the accumulated psychological and physiological content that causes the cyclical pattern in your life and even beyond. If you can be constantly conscious of this space between you and the body-mind, you have opened up a dimension of limitless possibility. There are only two forms of suffering in this world, physical and mental. Once this distance becomes a constant factor in your experience, you have reached the end of suffering. With the elimination of the fear of suffering, you can walk life full stride, unafraid to explore all that life has to offer. Your ability to use this immensely sophisticated body-mind phenomena can be raised to a completely new dimension of experience and utility as you stand outside of them. This sounds paradoxical, but it is true. As the experience of space grows, mind is no more a mess. It is a great symphony, tremendous possibility, that can take you to great heights. Yoga is a journey towards a reality in which you experience the ultimate nature of existence as borderless unity. This experience is possible only if you maintain the space between you and your body-mind. It is important to remember that this borderless unity is an experience, not an idea, philosophy, or concept. If you vouch for the oneness of the universe as an intellectual theory, this may make you popular at a dinner party or win you applause at a seminar. You may even get a Nobel Prize, but it does not serve any other purpose. The experience of borderless unity, on the other hand, can deliver you to another dimension altogether, a dimension of love and blissfulness, a dimension far beyond the cerebral. It can actually be damaging to an individual to see everything as one intellectually. People often profess all kinds of fancy philosophical theories about becoming one with the cosmos, about loving the entire world, until life teaches them a good lesson. When it comes to money, the boundary between self and other is abundantly clear. At such times, there is no question of you and me being one. Once it happened, Shankaran Pillai went to Vedanta class. Vedanta is the school of Indian metaphysics that speaks of the non-duality of the self and the divine. The teacher, a learned philosopher, was in full swing. You are not just this or that. You are everywhere. There is nothing like yours and mine. Everything is you. Everything is yours. In essence, everything is one. What you see, hear, smell, taste, touch is not reality. It is all maya, all illusion. This unbeatable Vedanta rhetoric was buzzing in Shankaran Pillai's head. He went home and slept on it. He woke in the morning, totally fired up. Usually he loved to sleep, but because of this Vedanta, he sprang out of bed. The first thoughts in his mind, there is nothing which is not mine. Everything is mine. Everything is me. All that is in this world is me. Everything is maya. You know, whatever the philosophy, may be, hunger happens at regular intervals. So Shankaran Pillai went to his favorite restaurant, ordered a big breakfast, devoured it, saying to himself, "Food is me. The one who serves is also me. One who eats is also me. Vedanta." He finished his breakfast. When he is in such a high state of Vedanta, mundane issues like paying the bill did not occur to him. He rose and started walking out. When everything is yours, how can there be a bill? As he passed the cash counter, the owner happened to turn away to attend to some other chore. Shankaran Pillai saw a huge heap of currency in the till. Immediately, Vedanta told him, "Everything is yours. You cannot differentiate between what is this and that." So because his pockets were quite empty, he put his hand into the box, took some cash, stuffed it into his pocket, and sauntered out of the restaurant. He was not out to rob anybody. He was just practicing Vedanta. Suddenly, a few people from the restaurant ran up and caught him. Shankaran Pillai said, "Who are you trying to catch? You are the catcher and the caught. What you catch is you. One that catches is also you. When there is no such thing as you and me, who can I pay?" The owner was bewildered. Only one thing was clear to him. "My cash is in your pocket." But here was Shankaran Pillai saying, "The one who catches is also me. The one who is caught is also me." The owner did not know how to deal with this kind of customer. At his wit's end, he took Shankaran Pillai to the court. There Shankaran Pillai continued his Vedanta. The judge tried in many ways to make him understand that he had committed a theft, but to no avail. When judge gave up and said, "Okay, 10 lashes on the backside." First lash, Shankaran Pillai screamed. The judge said, "Don't worry. It is all Maya anyway. There is no such thing as pain and pleasure. Everything is Maya." Second lash, Shankaran Pillai shouted, "Enough." The judge said, "One who lashes is you. The one who is lashed is also you." Third lash, Shankaran Pillai hollered, "Stop, stop. There is no such thing as starting and stopping. It is all Maya." It was like this all the way to 10 lashes. Before the 10 lashes were done, Vedanta had been cleaned right out of Shankaran Pillai. An intellectual understanding that is not backed by experience can lead to mind games and deceptive states. But if oneness becomes an experiential reality, it will not produce an immature action. It will produce a tremendous experience of life that will leave you transformed forever. Universality is not an idea. It is an existential truth. It is individuality that is an idea. Yoga is simply chitta vritti nirodha. That means, if the activity of your mind ceases and you are still alert, you are in yoga. But do not try to forcibly stop the mental activity, because you will go insane. With your mind, all the 3 pedals are throttles. There are no brakes and no clutch. Have you noticed this? Whatever pedal you hit, the mind only accelerates its speed. But if you don't pay any attention to it, thoughts will slowly subside, leaving you in a rich and vibrant silence. Sadhana. Remind yourself at least once an hour that everything you are carrying, your handbag, your money, your relationships, the heaviness in your heart and body, are things that you have accumulated over a period of time. If you become more and more conscious of this fundamental fact, even as a process of disidentification grows within you, balanced by a deep sense of involvement in everything around you, you will move from the misery and madness of the human mind towards meditativeness. Thinking yourself out of life. It is only because you exist that you can generate a thought. But your thought process has become so compulsive that your focus has shifted from the existential to the psychological. This has happened to such an extent that you have begun to believe that you exist because you think. The foundations of Western philosophy actually rest on the famous axiom by the 17th century French philosopher René Descartes, I think, therefore I am. It is time to restate a fundamental fact. You are, therefore you may think. This has nothing to do with any philosophy, Eastern or Western. It is a simple existential reality. You can be and still choose to think or not think. The most beautiful moments in your life, what you might consider moments of bliss, joy, ecstasy, or utter peace, were moments when you were not thinking about anything at all. You were just being. Even without your thoughts, existence is. What are thoughts really? Just information that you have gathered and recycled. Are you really capable of thinking of anything other than what has been accumulated by your mind? All human mind is doing is recycling old data. So I ask, do you want to be a living being or a thinking being? Right now, 90% of the time you're only thinking about life, not living it. Have you come into this world to experience life or to think about it? Your mental process is a very small happening compared to the life process. But right now, it has become far more important. It is time for humanity to shift the significance to the life process once again. The need is an urgent one. Our lives depend on it. Once it happened, this is almost an apocryphal tale, but that doesn't matter. It smells true. Aristotle, the father of modern logic, the intellectual giant of ancient Greece, was walking on the beach, a glorious sunset before him. But he had no time for such petty occurrences. He was thinking seriously about some great problem of existence. For the intellectual mind, existence is always a problem, and Aristotle was out to solve it. Lost in solemn thought, he paced up and down the beach. There was another man on the beach who was doing something very intensely, so intensely that after a while even Aristotle noticed him. Those who are immersed in their own psychological realities usually end up ignoring life around them. They seldom have the eyes to look at a flower, a sunset, a child, or a smiling face. And if it is an unsmiling face, they have no inclination to make it smile. They have no such small duties or minor cares in the world. They are too busy cracking the great puzzles of existence. But this man's intensity was such that even Aristotle could not ignore him. On close observation, he noticed that this man kept going to the ocean, returning with great single-mindedness of purpose. Aristotle paused in his reflections to inquire, "What exactly are you up to?" The man said, "Please don't disturb me. I am doing something very important." He continued with his work with furious intensity. Aristotle's curiosity was piqued. He asked again, "But what are you doing?" The man said, "Don't disturb me. It's very important." Aristotle said, "What is this important thing?" The man showed him a little hole he had dug in the sand and said, "I am emptying the ocean into this hole." He had a tablespoon in his hand. Aristotle looked at this and laughed. Now, Aristotle is the kind who can spend a whole year without a single chuckle. It takes a heart to laugh. The intellect cannot laugh. It can only dissect. But Even Aristotle laughed at this and said, "This is ridiculous. You must be insane. Do you know how vast this ocean is? How can you ever empty this ocean into this little hole, and above all with a tablespoon? At least if you had a bucket, you might have stood some chance. Please give this up. This is utter madness." The man looked at Aristotle, threw the spoon down, and said, "My job is already done." Aristotle said, "What do you mean? Forget about the ocean being empty. Even the hole is not full. How is your job done?" The other man stood up and said, "I am trying to empty the ocean into this little hole with a tablespoon. You are telling me it is madness, but what are you trying to do? Do you know how vast this existence is? It can contain a billion oceans like this and more, and you are trying to empty it into the small hole of your head. And with what? With tablespoons called thoughts. Please give it up. It is utterly ridiculous." The other man was Heraclitus, the great Greek philosopher. In a flash, he showed Aristotle what a crippled existence he was leading by attempting to extend his logic to every aspect of life. If you want to know the experiential dimensions of life, you will never know them with a petty process of thought, even if you have a brain of an Einstein. Your thought process is still outclassed because thought cannot be bigger than life. Thought can only be a logical functioning between two polarities. If you want to know life in its immensity, you need something more than the intellect. This is the fundamental choice you have. Either you learn to live with creation, or you manufacture your own creation in your head. Which option do you want to exercise? The planet is spinning on time, not a small event. All the galaxies are managing fine. The whole cosmos is doing great. But you have one nasty little thought crawling in your head, and it is a bad day. The problem is, you are living in a psychological space that bears no connection with reality, and you are insecure because it can collapse any moment. In the vastness and grandeur of cosmic space, if you look at yourself in perspective, you are less than a speck of dust, but you think your thought, which is less than a speck within you, should determine the nature of existence. You have lost your perspective of life. That is the basic problem. You have heard of the Buddha. His name was Siddhartha Gautama, and he became a Buddha. But Gautama was not the only Buddha. A human being who has transcended his intellect, the discriminatory and logical functions of his life, is a Buddha. Human beings have invented millions of ways to suffer. For all this, the manufacturing unit is just in your mind. Once you are no longer identified with your mind, you are free to experience life beyond limitations. Being a Buddha means that you have become a witness to your own intellect. The essence of yoga, as we have said before, is just this: to arrive at that moment where there is clear space between you and your mind. Once this happens, a life of heightened clarity, perception, and freedom has begun. This is the birth of freedom. Limits of logic. Without logical thinking, you couldn't survive on this planet. But at the same time, too much logic is suicide. Let us say you wake up tomorrow morning and start thinking 100% logically. Do not think about the sunrise, the birds in the sky, your child's face, the flowers blooming in your garden. Just think logically. Now you have to get up, go to the toilet, brush your teeth, eat, work, eat, work, eat, sleep. Again tomorrow morning, the same thing. For the next 30, 40 or 50 years, you have to do the same thing. If you think 100% logically, there is no reason for you to be alive. One day in New York City, a man was walking home late from work. Suddenly, he had a romantic idea. He went to the florist, bought a huge bunch of red roses, went home, and knocked on the door. His wife opened the door. She looked at him and started hollering, "Today has been a terrible day. The faucet has been leaking, the basement is flooded, the children had a food fight, and I had to clean the whole place, the dog has been sick, my mother is not well, and you have the cheek to come home drunk?" So if you think 100% logically, there is really no possibility of life. Moments of extreme logic are moments of suicide. Only if you know when logic should be used and when it is necessary to go beyond it, will your life be beautiful. Sadhana. You could try this simple practice. Set your water tap in such a way that only 5 to 10 drops fall per minute. See if you can observe each drop, how it forms, how it falls, how it splashes on the ground. Do this for 15 to 20 minutes a day. You will gradually become conscious of many things around and within you that you are completely unaware of right now. This simple exercise can initiate a process of sensitization and clarity and accomplish much more than you can possibly imagine. In this simple process, you are actually exploring one limb of yoga, referred to as dharana, which means that which flows. It is not the water we are referring to here. It is your attention, and in turn, your consciousness. The attempt is to make your attention flow and connect with its object, in this case, water. This is not an exercise in observation or appreciation. It is an exercise in attention, in turning what is sporadic and intermittent into a flow. In the larger scheme of things, the water and you are already one. Your individuality is only your idea. The grime of identity. The intellect is like a scalpel. Its function is to slice through reality and enable you to discern one thing from another. If a knife has to cut through anything effortlessly, it is important that the substance it encounters does not stick to it. A sticky knife is obviously an ineffective implement. Suppose you use a knife to cut a cake today, tomorrow you cut meat, and the day after you cut fruit. If all these residues were to stick to the knife, it would turn over time into a useless instrument. You have probably experienced this already. If you cut mangoes or apples after cutting an onion, everything smells like onion. Such a knife becomes more of a hindrance than help. In other words, once your intellect gets identified with something, it gets chained to the identifications and leaves you with a completely distorted experience of the world. Once it happened, for political reasons, Akbar, the emperor, was separated in his infancy from his mother. Another woman, who had a child of her own, was brought in to nurse him. This woman breastfed Akbar and was later offered a reward for her services. Her boy, who was still a child, slightly older than Akbar, was allotted a few villages and was made a small ruler. Many years later, Akbar was crowned emperor, But this boy, who lacked the intelligence and capability required of a ruler, squandered all his resources, lost all that was given to him, and grew impoverished. When he was about 32 years of age, a grand idea occurred to him. He thought, "Since the emperor and I drank the same mother's milk, we are brothers, and since I was born first, I am the elder brother." With this idea planted firmly in his head, he went to Akbar and told him the same story. "See, we are brothers. I am elder to you. But look at my sorry state. I am poor. You are an emperor. How can you leave me like this?" Akbar was deeply moved. He welcomed him, set him up in the palace, treated him like a king. The man was not accustomed to the ways of the court and committed many stupid blunders. But the generous Akbar kept saying, "He is my elder brother. We have drunk the milk from the same mother." He introduced him to everybody as his elder brother. This was the state of affairs for some time. Then it was time for the man to return to his village. Akbar said, "My brother, you lost those villages given to you. I shall give you 5 new villages to rule, a small kingdom of your own." The man said, "But I see that you have become this successful because there are a lot of smart people around you. I don't have anybody to advise me. That is why I am lost. If only I had good advisors and ministers, I would also have built a major empire. Above all, you have Birbal. He is so smart. If only I had somebody like him, I would also be a great emperor." Akbar said, "If you wish, you may take Birbal with you." He summoned Birbal and ordered him, "You must go with my elder brother." Birbal said, "Your Highness, your elder brother deserves someone better than me. Why not my elder brother? I could send him instead." Akbar thought that that was a great idea because he did not relish the prospect of losing Birbal. Delighted, he said, "Summon him immediately." The next day, this man was to leave for his new kingdom, and a grand farewell was organized in court. There was a mood of anticipation in the air as everyone waited for Birbal to arrive with his elder brother. Finally, Birbal entered with a bull in tow. "What is this?" Akbar asked. Birbal said, "This is my elder brother." Akbar was furious. "Are you trying to insult me and my brother?" "No, my lord," said Birbal. "He is my elder brother. Both of us drank milk from the same mother. Once your intellect, or buddhi, as it is termed in yogic taxonomy, gets identified with something, you function within the realm of this identity. Whatever you are identified with, all your thoughts and emotions spring from that identity. Right now, suppose you identify yourself as a man, all your thoughts and emotions flow from that identification. If you identify yourself with your nationality or religion, they will flow from those identifications. Whatever your thoughts and emotions, these identifications are a certain level of prejudice. In fact, your mind is itself a certain kind of prejudice. Why? Because it functions from limited data and is fronted by an essentially discriminatory intellect. So your mind, which should have been a ladder to the divine, is tumbling through endless mediocrity, and on some occasions has become a straight stairway to hell. The identity around which the intellect functions is called ahankara. To continue with the earlier knife analogy, the hand that wields the knife is identity. Or in other words, it is your identity that manages and determines your intellect. When you use a knife, it is important not just to have a sharp blade, but a stable hand to hold it. Without a stable hand, you can end up cutting yourself in a million different ways. Most of the suffering that human beings undergo is not because of external situations. What is inflicted on them from outside is minimal. The rest is all self-help. Once you're identified with something that you are not. The mind is an express train that cannot be stopped. If you put the mind on full steam and want to apply the brakes, it will not work. But if you are able to disentangle yourself from everything that you are not, if you disidentify, as it were, you will see that the mind turns blank and empty. When you want to use it, you can. At other times, it will simply be empty, devoid of all psychological clutter. That is how it should be. Right now, you are identified with so many labels. At the same time, you're trying to stop your mind. This will simply not work. Irrespective of what you think you are, when death confronts you, every identification falls away. If human beings learn to drop these voluntarily, life would be blissful. If you do not encumber your intellect with any identifications, body, gender, family, qualification, society, race, caste, creed, community, nation, even species, you travel naturally towards your ultimate nature. If not, death will demolish it all anyway. You need have no doubt about that. If you employ your intelligence and make an attempt to reach your ultimate nature, this is called Jnana Yoga, or the yoga of knowing. Jnana Yogis cannot afford to identify themselves with anything. If they do, that is the end of their journey. But unfortunately, what has happened to Jnana Yoga, at least in India, is that its proponents entertain several beliefs. I am the universal soul, the absolute, the supreme being. They know it all from the arrangement of the cosmos to the shape and size of the soul. They have read all these things in a book. This is not Jnana Yoga. Any information you have about that which is not a living experience for you is irrelevance. Maybe it is very holy irrelevance, but it does not liberate you. It only entangles you. On a certain day, a bull was grazing on a field. He went deep into the forest and after weeks of grazing on lush grass, became nice and fat. A lion who was past his prime and having difficulty hunting his prey saw this nice fat bull, pounced on him, killed him, and ate him up. His stomach became full. Then with great satisfaction he roared. A few hunters were passing by. They heard the roar and tracked him down and shot him dead. The moral of the story: when you are so full of bull, you should not open your mouth. Very few people have the necessary intellect to pursue Jnana Yoga 100%. Most need a huge amount of preparation. There is an entire yogic process to make your intellect so razor sharp that it does not stick to anything, but it is very time-consuming because the mind is a tricky customer. It is capable of creating a million illusions. Jnana Yoga, as a part of your spiritual pursuit, is a workable proposition. As an exclusive path, it is only for a very rare few. Sadhana. Just sit alone for an hour. No reading, no television, no phone, no communication, nothing. Just see, in the course of this hour, what thoughts dominate your mind, whether it's food, sex, your car, your furniture, your jewelry, or anything else. If you find yourself thinking recurrently about people or things, your identification is essentially with your body. If your thoughts are about what you would like to do in the world, your identification is essentially with your mind. Everything else is a complex set of offshoots of these two aspects. This is not a value judgment. It is just a way of knowing what stage of life you are at. How quickly you want to evolve depends on your own choices. Soak the intellect in awareness. In the yogic system of classification, the mind has 16 dimensions. These 16 fall into four categories. There is the discerning or discriminatory dimension of the mind, or the intellect, the buddhi, the accumulative dimension of the mind, or memory, manas, which gathers information, and what is called awareness, chitta, which is beyond both intellect and memory. The fourth dimension, ahankara, we discussed earlier, the aspect of the mind from which you derive your sense of identity. The first dimension, the intellect or the buddhi, is crucial for your survival. You are able to discern a person from a tree only because your intellect is functional. You know that you must walk through the door, not through the wall, only because your intellect is functional. Without this dimension of discernment, you would not know how to survive on this planet. On more complex and sophisticated levels, intellect has contributed immeasurably to human culture and civilization. The problem of our times, however, is that the intellect has taken on a disproportionately important role. Modern education has encouraged a completely lopsided development of this aspect of the mind. The essence of the intellect is to divide. So humanity has embarked on a journey of wholesale division, discrimination, and dissection. We have split everything. Even the invisible atom has been split. Once you unleash the intellect, it splits everything it encounters. It does not allow you to be with anything totally. Although it is a wonderful instrument for survival, it is also at the same time a terrible barrier that stands between you and your experience of the oneness of life. How do we address this problem? Yoga offers us a way. In our times, it is not just a useful strategy, it is perhaps our only chance of reversing a journey that seems to be taking us headlong towards self-destruction. The intellect is becoming a barrier because you keep it constantly dipped in the accumulative part of the mind, your memory, manas. Examine this for yourself. You will find that every thought that arises in the mind has its roots in data you have already accumulated. The data may be gathered consciously or unconsciously. In any case, this basically means your intellect is perpetually immersed in the past. In such a state, nothing new is now possible, and so the intellect loses its edge and becomes a trap. The accumulative part of the mind is, to put it simply, just society's garbage bin. It is merely a heap of impressions you have gathered from outside. Anybody you encounter stuffs something into your head and moves on. Your parents, teachers, friends, enemies, preachers, the news anchors on the TV, just about everyone. You have no choice about who to receive from and who not to receive from. The moment you say, "I don't like this person," you often end up receiving much more from him or her than anybody else. You have the ability to process the information you receive, but that is all. Your ability to merely recycle the garbage you have picked up is what the mighty intellect has been reduced to. The blitzkrieg of information that your mind receives daily enters you only through your five sense organs. Your sense organs, as we have seen before, always perceive everything only in comparison. Where there is comparison, there is always duality. Suppose I were to show you my hand. While you are able to see one side, you cannot see the other. If I were to show you the other side, you won't be able to perceive this first sight. Human perception, through the sense organs, is always piecemeal. It can give you an illusion of completeness, but can never comprehend the whole. When you keep your intellect dipped in this limited, fragmented, accumulative dimension of your mind, you draw conclusions about life that are completely distorted. The more people become engrossed in thought, the more joyless they become. It is unfortunate, but let me be clear. Thought in itself is not a problem. People who think with clarity should be joyful. Unfortunately, for many people, the more they think, the more incapable they become of smiling. The problem is just that they have enslaved their faculty of discernment to the limitations of their sense perception. But the same intellect can be sharpened if you allow it to soak in the other aspect of your mind, your awareness, chitta. If you want to reach your ultimate nature through the mind, you need to make the intellect truly discriminatory, in the ultimate sense. This does not mean dividing everything good and bad, right and wrong, high and low, heaven and hell, sacred and profane. Instead, all it means is learning to discern the real from the illusory, what is existentially true from what is psychologically true. If you soak your intellect in your awareness, the discerning dimension of your mind can turn into a miraculous tool of liberation. It can become razor sharp, slice through what is true and untrue, and deliver you to a different dimension of life altogether. Learn to place your intellect in the sheath of your awareness rather than in the slack of memory and identification. Once you do this, this tremendous instrument can cut its way effortlessly towards the ultimate. Sadhana. If you consciously walk a tightrope, you have no choice but to be aware. If your intellect is constantly choosing between good and bad, it has become a prejudiced intellect. And when it is busy sorting the world into good and bad, you will most definitely fall off the tightrope. Don't take the tightrope literally. You could just try bringing a certain precision into the physical movements of the body. If you have a Hatha Yoga practice, it should happen anyway. For instance, if you see a straight line on the floor, try walking in perfect alignment with that line, maintaining an easy gait. It is not about becoming self-conscious, but about becoming precise or exact. Try this with your body and see. Bring precision into every movement, every gesture. This is one way of dipping your intellect in awareness. Awareness is aliveness. What do we mean by the word awareness, anyway? What does it signify? And how can we access it? First and foremost, let us make an important distinction. Awareness is not mental alertness. Mental alertness will only enhance your ability to survive in the world. It is a dog-like alertness, useful in self-preservation, but not in self-expansion. Awareness is not something that you do. Awareness is what you are. Awareness is aliveness. The dimension of the mind that modern societies have completely ignored at their own peril is awareness or chitta. This is intelligence that is completely unsullied by memory. This is the deepest dimension of the mind and one that connects you with that which is the very basis of creation. When you